The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's issue is for August 3 and August 10. The front cover, as usual, is banded in red, and today there's a black and white photograph of a young man. The caption is for Steve Shapiro of Getty Images, who provided the photograph. It's a young man looking either very angry or very stern or very serious, perhaps all of the above. It's a young man of color. He has short, cropped hair, very well sculpted around his forehead and to his ears in the temple area. He's wearing a white short-sleeved dress shirt and a tie, which is in a dark shade with some type of figurative print on it. They look like circles, but they're not all circles. Some are circles within circles. He has his hands on his hips, so his elbows are at almost right angles out from his body. And he's either standing very near or leaning against a dark brick wall. Again, the photo is in black and white. The title reads John Lewis, 1940 to 2020. Our first article is under the subtitle Conversation, and it says behind the cover. And there's a small inset photo here of a young man wearing a dark suit, a white shirt, and a tie. His hair's all tousled because he's running. He is a Caucasian. He has at least five cameras slung around his neck and over both shoulders. The photo on the cover of this week's issue shows the late Georgia Congressman John Lewis as a 23-year-old civil rights activist in Clarksdale, Mississippi, just weeks before he was to speak at the 1963 March on Washington. One of Lewis's favorite photos of himself, it was taken by Steve Shapiro, pictured in the inset photo, who was then on assignment photographing civil rights activists for Life magazine. You see, he's looking forward with an enormous amount of strength in terms of how he sees the future, says Shapiro, now 85 and living in Chicago. It is a picture of someone who knows who he is, knows what he has to do, and for the rest of his life, after this picture, he did it. Back in time, beginning of a dream. Here's a colored photo of lots of people, mostly men, all lined up under heavily leafed green trees. They're on some type of pavement because there is white striping beneath their feet. Some are people of color, some are Caucasian, some are wearing hats. All are wearing suits, white shirts, and ties. One catches a glimpse, only a glimpse, of a few women in the second row and further back, and they appear to be wearing dresses, but it's difficult to say because they're nearly hidden by this first line, the first detail. They're carrying signs, too. Some of the signs read, "We march for jobs for all now," and "We demand an end to bias now." "We demand decent housing now." "We march for first-class citizenship now." By the time John Lewis died, the leader whose legacy is explored in this week's issue was known as the Conscience of Congress. But when he first rose to prominence as a leader of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC, many Americans were not ready to listen to what he had to say. Lewis made an early appearance in the pages of Time in the magazine's coverage of the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. As the September 6, 1963 issue reported, Lewis had planned to deliver a speech scorching President Kennedy's civil rights legislation package as too little and too late. The draft's promise that black Americans would march through the heart of Dixie the way Sherman did prompted Washington's Roman Catholic Archbishop, as well as other civil rights leaders, to ask Lewis to tone down his rhetoric. He finally gave in, but not very far, Time noted, of a speech that still moved the audience. The crowd, most of it standing and packed shoulder to shoulder, began getting restless, but its attention was caught by Lewis's aggressive words. Decades later, Lewis recalled that after his indignation faded, the call for compromise offered a lesson on teamwork. You can read more about Lewis's recollection of that moment on page 34, which we will. And more than a half century later, another observation from the magazine's coverage stands out. The March on Washington was a triumph. But after everybody agreed on that, the question was, why? Hardly in terms of immediate results, since there were none. The battle cry of the march was now. Seas of placards demanded Negro equality now. Speakers demanded action now. Cried John Lewis, "We want our freedom and we want it now." But now remained a long way off. It would not come today, tomorrow, next month, or next year. One last chance. Readers concerned for the environment were thrilled with that Time's July 27 special issue was devoted to climate change. "The earth is speaking to us, saying, 'Enough is enough, let me heal,'" wrote Ira Saltzman of Lincolnwood, Illinois. Jim Law of El Cajon, California, found Jill Pelto's cover illustration more powerful than words. Mike Booza of Swartz Creek, Michigan, called the issue a ray of hope and timely, given that pollution disproportionately affects minority communities. But Kenneth Kerr of Austin called for more coverage of nuclear power as an alternative energy source. And referring to the cover line, "One Last Chance," James P. McGill in Reno, Nevada, argued, "That last chance will come in November, when Americans can vote in politicians supportive of a bold climate agenda." For the record, we must not let COVID-19 distract us from tackling other pressing health threats. From Dr. Matshisido Moeti, WHO, WHO Africa Regional Director. The organization reported more than 50 cases of Ebola in the Democratic Republic of Congo's Equateur province as of July 16. They don't treat us like humans. They don't even treat us like animals. They treat us like a number. From Raul Medina Perez, who was held in immigration detention in Colorado for nearly 11 months before being released in July. "Activists have been working to get detainees released as COVID-19 threatens to spread through federal facilities." $5 bonus cash offered by Wisconsin's Community State Bank for every $100 worth of coins turned in. The offer, launched July 14, comes in the midst of a pandemic-induced coin shortage. The program met its goals in just 1 week. Good news of the week. A 4-year-old Labrador retriever from Olathe, Kansas, went missing, only to show up at her owner's old home, more than 50 miles away in Lawson, Missouri. Local news reported July 16. "I have often said I would remain a member of the court as long as I can do the job full steam," Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Supreme Court Justice, in a July 17 statement disclosing the 87-year-old jurist is receiving chemotherapy to treat a recurrence of cancer. It truly is a celebration for the whole community, from Antonella Invernizzi, mayor of Morterone, the smallest village in Italy, after the hamlet's first birth in 8 years on July 19 brought its population to 29. I have to see. No, I'm not going to just say yes. I'm not going to say no, and I didn't last time either. Donald Trump, U.S. president, refusing to say whether he would accept the results of the November presidential election in an interview with Fox News that aired July 19. $1.8 million. Sale price for a rare LeBron James trading card that sold at auction July 18. The card, which shows a rookie James from the 2003-04 season, is the highest-priced basketball card ever sold. And now to the brief. A man and a woman are shown sitting in lawn chairs. They're like the nylon canvas-type fabric folding chairs up against a cinder block wall. Both are wearing masks, both are wearing glasses, both are wearing jeans. He's wearing a dark-colored T-shirt and a dark-colored cap, and she's wearing a brown and white print shirt, sandals. Her face mask is yellow, his is white. Off the job, as benefits hang in the balance, people wait at an unemployment processing event in Tulsa, Oklahoma, July 15. The brief opener, economy. For the jobless, there is no secure safety net, by Alana Samuels. As millions of American jobs disappeared over the past few months, in some cases forever, there was one consolation for the newly unemployed. They could receive $600 a week more than usual in unemployment benefits, part of an impromptu safety net created by Congress in the early days of the pandemic to supplement the often meager benefits people would normally have received. But that program had a July 31 expiration date, and many desperate situations could become far bleaker if Congress does not extend federal pandemic unemployment compensation, FPUC. The enhanced unemployment benefits approved in March. In Arkansas, people receiving $681 a week could see that drop to $81 a week. The maximum unemployment benefit in Tennessee could revert to $275 a week. Even where the base support is higher, benefits expire after a set number of weeks, as would an extension. No one knows how long the pandemic will continue to wreak havoc on the economy. Megan K. Rocks, a 38-year-old single mother in Athens, Georgia, expects to see her weekly income go from $725 to $125. After the events company, where Rocks worked as a graphic designer, cleared its calendar for the year, the extra $600 a week helped cover rent, car insurance, and other bills. It also meant that amid an absence of child care options, she could stay home with her 11-year-old son. The looming expiration of these benefits leaves Rocks few options. At this point, she says, I have no idea what I'm going to do. It is not just individuals who've benefited from the enhanced safety net. It is the entire economy. The extra unemployment benefits helped bring tens of millions of Americans' earnings up to the average U.S. weekly wage, allowing them to pay for necessities and maybe even spend on extras like school supplies or entertainment. That spending helped support as many as 2.8 million jobs, reducing the unemployment rate by as much as 1.8%, according to the Joint Economic Committee. Crucially, much of the spending happening right now can be attributed to lower-income individuals. Harvard researchers recently found people at the bottom of the income ladder are spending nearly as much as they did before the pandemic, while high-income households have dramatically curtailed spending. About 25 million Americans will continue to be unemployed throughout the summer and early fall, according to estimates from the Congressional Budget Office. Without additional unemployment benefits, low-earner spending will plummet, costing even more jobs. While there are other parts of the safety net that may help some families get by, including food stamps, emergency rental assistance, and cash assistance for low-income families with children, the human toll of losing extra unemployment benefits will still be dramatic. People could lose homes. Those now able to pay credit card debt will fall behind. Bankruptcies are likely to soar. Already, as local and state eviction moratoriums expire, evictions are on the rise. That situation could worsen if a federal moratorium on evictions from rental properties that have federally backed mortgages would be allowed to expire July 25. Like so many of the impacts of COVID-19, the loss of extra unemployment benefits would be felt most by people of color. Annette Alcala, a 30-year-old Latina server in New York City, fell behind on her bills after the Times Square restaurant where she worked closed in March. She is 3 months behind on rent and does not know how she will catch up if her benefits drop to $300 a week. There are not any jobs available, she says. The unemployment rate in June was 15.4% for Black Americans and 14.5% for Hispanics, compared with 10.1% for white Americans, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Black and Latino workers held many of the service sector jobs affected by the pandemic. As states slow reopenings and companies keep workers remote, these jobs will remain scarce. The crisis facing jobless Americans highlights the tangled condition of unemployment insurance in the U.S., where payouts vary drastically from state to state. Florida's maximum unemployment benefit in normal times is $275 a week. But Massachusetts is $823. The jobless get as little as $37 a week in Indiana and $15 a week in North Carolina, according to 2019 Department of Labor data. States can be as stingy as they want, says Michelle Evermore, a senior policy analyst at the National Employment Law Project, who says states are starting to program FPUC out of their computer systems. People's lives will be ruined without the funds, Evermore says. Legal advocates are concerned that some families will be driven to take out high-interest loans, which could send them into an endless cycle of poverty. Even during the best of times, people have a hard time making ends meet, says Kevin DeLieben, an attorney at Legal Aid of Arkansas, which is seeing an upswell of worried clients. People like Sam Nelson, a single father living near Orlando, are bracing for the worst. He's been unemployed since March after losing his jobs as a bartender and a theme park concierge and tour guide. Nelson does not know how he'd manage on $275 a week. The extra benefits, he says, are literally vital to survival. From the bulletin, armed groups step in to stem COVID-19 in Latin America. That's armed groups. Colombia's president has begun easing a stringent COVID-19 lockdown, but his are not the only rules Colombians have been following. A July 15 report by Human Rights Watch, HRW, said armed groups in a third of the country's 32 states have been enforcing their own lockdowns, often using violence. Analysts say guerrillas and gangs across Latin America have used fighting the virus as a way to strengthen their control of territory. That is making the region's problem of criminal governance even worse. COVID-19 control, the lack of a strong state presence in remote areas of Colombia, allows guerrillas to act as the main authority, while drug gangs control poor regions of Mexico and urban favelas in Brazil. As income-generating activities like trafficking and extortion have become harder during national coronavirus lockdowns, some armed groups have leaned into their role as local governors, says Chris Dalby of the investigative site Insight Crime. They have taken the opportunity to reaffirm their control. New rules after COVID-19 started to spread in Latin America in March, gangs in Rio de Janeiro's favelas gave out soap and imposed a curfew. Mexico's Gulf Cartel handed out boxes of food and other supplies. In Colombia, the National Liberation Army and other rebel groups distributed threatening pamphlets listing their quarantine rules. HRW documented at least 8 killings of civilians who apparently did not comply from March to June. Lasting change. The pandemic helped gangs and guerrillas bolster their legitimacy by creating the impression they care about the public interest, says Juan Papier, author of the HRW Colombia report. That may permanently strengthen their control. But perhaps more concerning for regional governments is what comes next. The levels of poverty that we're going to see after this pandemic will make it very easy to drive people to illegal activities, Papier says. That's the best environment for these groups to thrive. And that article was by Chiara Nugent. From the news ticker, this is a column with a trio of very short items. Pompeo complaint made public. A heavily redacted whistleblower complaint about alleged misconduct by Secretary of State Mike Pompeo was released July 17. 3 congressional committees are investigating Pompeo's part in the May firing of the State Department Inspector General who was investigating him. Court deals setback to felons voting. The Supreme Court dealt a blow to voting rights for ex-felons in Florida July 16 by declining to reverse a lower court's order that allowed a law to take effect requiring ex-felons to pay off all fees, fines, and restitution before voting. The law followed a 2018 referendum in which some 1.4 million people with felony convictions regained their voting rights. U.S. to China. Close Houston consulate. The U.S. ordered China to close its Houston consulate July 21, calling it an epicenter of an economic espionage and intellectual property theft campaign amid a deepening diplomatic row between the two nations. Beijing said it would retaliate. Under science, unfathomable. New research published July 16 revealed the discovery of 16 species of ultra-black fish, which seem to disappear in the ocean by trapping 99.5% of the light that hits their surface, allowing them to avoid predators. Other ocean mysteries are unraveled. This short column is by Madeline Roche. The bloop. Contrary to popular suggestions, an extremely loud sound heard in the ocean in 1997, known as the bloop, came not from an unknown animal, but from glacial movements, scientists confirmed in 2012. sand circles. More than a decade after discovering circular patterns on the seabed near Japan in 1995, scientists found the creators were a new species of pufferfish, which make the ornate circles to attract mates. Red tides. Scientists can now forecast the emergence of often harmful red tides around the world after discovering that among the causes are ocean salinity, wind, temperature, and explosive growths in algae. And here is a photograph. It is so dark. It is black on black. One sees just minor highlights and lighter shades of gray that lead to the image of a fish. So perhaps that is the ultra-black fish that was described. Good question. What can the world learn from the Asia-Pacific COVID-19 surge? As much of the rest of the world struggled with the coronavirus pandemic, it looked as if many places across Asia and the Pacific had successfully suppressed the virus. In Australia, some experts began talking about eliminating COVID-19 completely. In Tokyo, the government lifted all restrictions on businesses. And in Hong Kong, life had begun to resemble pre-pandemic times. Bars and restaurants filled up with patrons. Employees largely returned to office buildings, and students went back to school. But that optimism is now being replaced with renewed lockdowns and social distancing restrictions as cases across the region tick up again. On July 22, both Hong Kong and the Australian state of Victoria, where Melbourne is located, hit daily highs, with 113 and 484 new cases, respectively. Tokyo broke a single-day record of its own July 17 with 293 cases. Experts say resurgences like these are inevitable and should serve as a warning to the rest of the world as it attempts to reopen. No one likes moving backward, especially to the dreaded lockdown. Victoria, like much of Australia, implemented lockdown restrictions in late March that required most people to stay home, except for activities like grocery shopping. Officials began to lift the restrictions in mid-May as cases declined. Then, July 8, some 5 million people were ordered back into lockdown after COVID-19 cases jumped. Protocol breaches are being blamed, including security guards reportedly having sex with travelers quarantined in hotels. For Ellen Sowersby, who lives outside Melbourne, returning to lockdown means facing the stark realization that we are not going to get back to normal anytime soon. Hong Kong's coronavirus surge shows rigorous testing and contact tracing and widespread mask wearing are not enough. Social distancing is needed as well, says Ben Cowling, an infectious disease epidemiology professor at the University of Hong Kong. But acting quickly can still squash an emergent outbreak. When a cluster of new coronavirus cases emerged in Beijing in June, authorities said they were entering wartime mode, placing neighborhoods under lockdown, closing schools, testing some 11 million residents. July 19, officials declared the situation under control. The good news for residents and for the rest of the watching world is that governments are taking the new outbreaks seriously and ramping up many of the strategies that made them successful in the first place. That column was by Amy Gunia, Hong Kong. And here's another trio of very short items under the news ticker heading. Report, UK ignored Russia interference. The UK government and intelligence agencies ignored the threat of Russian interference in the country's democracy, including during the Brexit referendum, despite indications the UK was a target. According to a report released July 21 by British lawmakers, Russia has dismissed the claims. Ohio speaker arrested in bribery case. Larry Householder, Ohio House Speaker, was arrested July 21, along with four others, in a massive federal bribery case. An FBI criminal complaint alleges an entity controlled by Householder received $60 million in exchange for help securing a bailout for two nuclear plants. Worst rains in decades caused China flooding. Some 40 million people across China have been affected by the nation's worst floods in recent years, which left at least 141 people dead or missing and damaged some 150,000 homes. The rains swelled the Yangtze River, raising water levels July 19 at the Three Gorges Dam, upriver from the city of Wuhan. Returning to the cover story of the late John Lewis, in his own words, there's another black and white photo here, mostly again of men of all racial backgrounds in dark suits, white shirts and ties. Some are wearing sunglasses. Some are wearing bow ties. Some are wearing armbands. One young man is wearing an armband with an M, as in Mickey, on it. Some are wearing hats, some of the gentlemen. The women and the men are mostly seated, so it appears that a couple of the women are wearing sheaths, dresses, but it's unclear as to what their attire is. There's a young man standing at the podium speaking into at least six microphones. It is John Lewis addressing a crowd at the 1963 March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. The 1963 March on Washington is best known for Martin Luther King Jr.'s iconic I Have a Dream speech. But the address that John Lewis delivered that day, as well as the one he did not deliver, would also go down in history. It loomed large in the biography of the future congressman. When Lewis spoke to Time in 2013 for the 50th anniversary of the march, he said he vividly remembered being introduced to hundreds of thousands of people who had gathered, eager to hear from a 23-year-old who was quickly taking a leadership role in the civil rights movement. This is by Josiah Bates. I stood up and I said to myself, "This is it," Lewis told Time. I looked straight out and I started speaking. At the time, Lewis was chairman of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC, which had helped plan the August 1963 event. As the group's leader, Lewis would get Time at the podium. Those of us in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee wanted the speech to speak for the hundreds of thousands of young people and people not so young that we were working with in the heart of the Deep South, Lewis said. We prepared a speech that we thought reflected the feelings, the ideas of the people. Bob Zellner, who was then the field secretary for the SNCC, recalled the organization was likely the most militant out of all the groups involved in organizing the march, and so there was pressure on Lewis to censor his comments. They wanted to temper that speech, and we thought that it was the time not to temper the speech, Zellner told Time. The speech Lewis ended up giving criticized both major political parties, charging that neither Republicans nor Democrats were doing enough to help the cause. Where is the political party that will make it unnecessary to march on Washington? He asked. He also made use of the word revolution, even though some people behind the scenes at the march opposed using the term. The speech acknowledged that many people who might have liked to have been there were not, as they were scraping out a living. While we stand here, there are sharecroppers in the Delta of Mississippi who are out in the fields working for less than $3 a day, 12 hours a day. Those who were there, however, felt he was speaking right to them. He talked about what was actually happening in the field, Doris Derby, who was then a volunteer with SNCC, said. People being beaten and the bombings. So he was talking about things we knew about. While most of the speech was viewed as radical by many, one part came in for particular targeting, the end. Lewis had intended to conclude the speech with the message that, if meaningful progress was not made quickly, activists would not confine our marching on Washington, as he recalled looking back in 2013, but rather would be forced to march through the South the way Sherman did, nonviolently. Lewis's invocation of Sherman's march to the sea, the 1864 progression of destruction by Union General William Tecumseh Sherman to Savannah, Georgia, was powerful, perhaps overly so. The goal of that march was to scare Georgia's citizens and convince them to leave the Confederate cause, and the specter of a modern version shook those who read his draft. They, other volunteers, said, "John, you can't use that," Lewis recalled. They said, "John, that doesn't sound like you. That's what Dr. King said." While the other volunteers were one thing, Lewis recalled, he could not say no to King. This man that I admired and loved, he was my inspiration, my hero. Ultimately, the end of the speech was changed, though not its strength. If we do not get meaningful legislation out of this Congress, the time will come when we will not confine our marching to Washington, Lewis told the crowd. We will march through the South, through the streets of Jackson, through the streets of Danville, through the streets of Cambridge, through the streets of Birmingham. But we will march with the spirit of love and with the spirit of dignity that we have shown here today. Here's another black and white photo. It's taking up two pages of the magazine's copy. The background is a brick wall with some windows inset as if they were basement windows. In front of the brick wall are kneeling at least five people, two of which are barely visible. One supposes there could be even more. Prominent among the three whom we see completely is one John Lewis. Again, dark slacks, dark shoes, well-worn, white shirt, short-sleeved, no tie. Head bowed along with the other two that are prominently displayed. Lewis demonstrates outside a segregated pool in Cairo, Illinois, in 1962. They went up one at a time and asked, "Can I come in?" the photographer recalls. Then all of a sudden they started to kneel and pray. The photograph is by Danny Lyon of Magnum Photos. The Risk Report by Ian Bremmer. Putin confronts a populist leader from his right. From his perch atop the Kremlin, Vladimir Putin has placed himself at the center of Russian politics for the foreseeable future, and anti-Western words and deeds have surely helped him get there. But the story now in is anger directed his way from his own country's east. With support from 78% of voters and 65% turnout, Putin won a referendum earlier in July establishing a new constitution that could extend his reign for decades. Yes, there were millions of contested ballots and prizes given to voters who showed up at the polls, but no one really expected a free or a fair vote, and credible numbers from the Russian polling firm Levada tell us that even a less popular Putin still has the approval of 60% of Russians. In general, opposition parties will continue to keep their opposition within bounds acceptable to Putin and his entourage. There have been times, however, when particular opposition figures have demonstrated an unhelpful independence. In 2018, a businessman turned politician named Sergei Forgal pulled off a shocking landslide election victory to become governor in the far eastern region of Khabarovsk. Forgal is a member of the Liberal Democratic Party, a nationalist right-wing party best known in the West for its leader, Vladimir Zhirinovsky, a charismatic political showman and a hate-monger. Forgal defeated the incumbent governor, a member of Putin's party. A year later, Forgal's LDPR finished first in elections for the region's assembly. Forgal is spelled F-U-R-G-A-L. This is a tough part of the country for Putin. His party's less popular here, a result of policies that many locals say have been imposed on them from faraway Moscow. How far away? The city of Khabarovsk is about 250 miles from the Pacific Ocean, 15 miles from Russia's border with China, and 5,000 miles from the Kremlin. The region did not back Putin's constitutional reform referendum with much enthusiasm. This is the backdrop for a decision, likely approved by Putin himself, to arrest Forgal, July 9. The popular governor has been charged with ordering contract killings of business rivals in 2004 and 2005, a time when he was building interests in metal and timber. To say the arrest was politically motivated is not to say Forgal is innocent. Once in custody, Forgal was flown to Moscow, where he's now awaiting trial. In response, tens of thousands of protesters hit the streets of Khabarovsk to express their fury. Some insist Forgal's innocent and should be released. Others call for an open trial in Khabarovsk. A few protesters have carried signs denouncing Putin. Many note the suspicious timing of his arrest, 15 years after the alleged crimes and just 8 days after Putin's referendum victory was secured. Moscow has dispatched lawmaker Mikhail Degtyarov to serve as interim governor until the next regional elections are held in September 2021. Though Degtyarov is also a member of Forgal's party rather than Putin's, he has no connection with Khabarovsk province. It's a reminder from faraway Moscow that Khabarov's elected governor does not work for the people of this region. What to make of all this? Populism is alive and well in Russia and might someday create real problems for Putin. Forgal won an election in 2018 because voters wanted to send a message to Moscow. As large-scale protests continue after more than a week, the arrest of their governor and his replacement with an outsider will only heighten their resentment. Putin has little to worry about, but these protests could be an early signal of populist challenges to come, particularly if Russia's economy continues its decline. Another small column here under the heading Technology by Patrick Lucas Austin. Lights, camera, zoom. As the pandemic rages on, those of us who are able to work from home will probably still be doing so for the foreseeable future. You know what that means, lots more video meetings. So why not look around and sound as good as possible? Here are three tips. Perfect your lighting. Good lighting can make up for even the lowest quality laptop cameras. Sit with a window to your side rather than behind you for a pleasant Rembrandt effect. If you cannot work beside a window, consider an LED fill light to make up for harsh indoor lighting. Upgrade your webcam. Even high-end laptops often have low-quality webcams. Adding an external webcam like the Logitech Brio 4K will give your video quality a big boost. Alternatively, software like Epic Cam can turn your smartphone into a makeshift webcam. Don't forget a mic. Why not sound as good as you look? A dedicated microphone like the Blue Snowball, we do not have that here, can dramatically improve the quality of your audio, making you sound just as good as your favorite podcasters. This article may be abridged for time constraints. It's under the View Nation. 30 years after a landmark disability law, the fight continues, by Abigail Abrams. Judy Heumann, H-E-U-M-A-N-N, remembers the day she went to register for kindergarten in 1952. She had gotten dressed up and her mother had pulled her wheelchair up a flight of stairs before the principal intervened. Her disability, he said, meant she was not allowed to attend school. This was in 1952. Heumann had polio as a child, and it left her legs paralyzed and limited her use of her hands and arms. Throughout her time in the educational system, and after she graduated and became a teacher and activist, she had to fight for access at every turn. "It is totally different today," she says. "That's thanks in large part to the Americans with Disabilities Act, ADA, the civil rights legislation that was signed 30 years ago this month, July 26, 1990, well, last month. Under that transformative law, schools and workplaces are now required to have ramps, elevators, designated parking spots, and curb cuts, and to provide accommodations for people with a range of disabilities, including those who are blind or deaf. Taking inspiration and legal concepts from the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the ADA was designed to protect people with disabilities against discrimination and to ensure they can participate fully in employment, state and local government services, public accommodations, transportation, and telecommunications. The results today are powerful. Most public buses have lifts for wheelchairs. Disabled children attend school alongside their non-disabled peers. Employers are generally aware that people with disabilities have civil rights they cannot violate. But if the 61 million Americans with disabilities that are now less likely to confront the same problems Heumann did decades ago, their fight for true equality is far from over. The ADA is ultimately a promise that has been tremendously impactful in some areas and has yet to be fulfilled in other areas, says Ari Neiman, a senior research associate at Harvard Law School, Project on Disability, and co-founder of the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network. The majority of disabled Americans still struggle to find jobs. Most affordable housing is still not accessible, and disabled Americans as a group experience much higher rates of poverty and incarceration. The ways that the ADA and other disability rights laws have been implemented often require navigating a host of bureaucratic mazes to access support. The ADA works in tandem with other laws, says Claudia Center, the legal director of the Disability Rights, Education, and Defense Fund. Each step needs to be made inclusive and accessible, and that is a big project. The passage of the ADA was decades in the making, built on years of grassroots advocacy, campus activism, the rise of the so-called independent living movement, which challenged the idea disabled people should be relegated to institutions. In the 70s, people with disabilities won a major victory when the 1973 Rehabilitation Act banned recipients of federal funds from discriminating on the basis of disability. It took 4 more years, nationwide protests, and a 28-day sit-in organized in part by Human to implement regulations that truly enforced the law. That work required that disabled people be able to come together to talk about what discrimination meant for different groups, how we as a community could be supportive of each other, learning about the forms of discrimination that we experience, learning about the kinds of alterations or accommodations that would need to be made, Human says. That advocacy laid the groundwork for what would become the ADA. There's a small photo here of President George H.W. Bush seated at a small writing table. He is outdoors, and the landscape behind him appears to include the Jefferson Memorial. On either side of him sit two gentlemen in wheelchairs, dressed in suits. Behind them stands one woman. And behind the other person in the wheelchair stands another man. Now, this man is dressed all in black. One wonders if he is a member of the clergy. But none of the people other than President Bush is identified in the photo. In the 1980s, Justin Dart, vice chair of the National Council on Disability, NCD, traveled the country, holding public meetings and collecting stories of discrimination. After the NCD drafted an initial bill, Senator Lowell Weicker and Representative Tony Coelho introduced the ADA in 1988. It was later championed by Senators Tom Harkin, Ted Kennedy, and Bob Dole. Even as the debates grew contentious and lawmakers moved to exclude people with AIDS or complained the bill would be too costly, advocates stuck together. Their unity ensured the ADA would eventually protect people with disabilities of all kinds. As President George H.W. Bush said at the law's signing ceremony, it will guarantee fair and just access to the fruits of American life, which we all must be able to enjoy. After a generation of advocacy, Human says, the ADA felt like a crescendo. But equality in theory does not mean equality in practice. 30 years after the ADA's passage, violations abound. Disability-related complaints remain the largest category filed with the federal agencies that enforce fair housing and employment laws, and many businesses and institutions remain inaccessible. At a more basic level, many disabled Americans say that while the ADA guaranteed them rights, it did little to address the historical inequities that have long pushed them to the margins of society. Children with disabilities are still less likely to graduate from high school and far less likely to attend college than their non-disabled peers. They're also disciplined more often in educational settings and overrepresented in the criminal justice system, where prisons are rarely set up to accommodate their needs. We have not really taken the concept of disability inclusion, of community support, of non-discrimination, and made that into programs and supports that prevent homelessness and incarceration, says Center. Access to employment, one of the central promises of the ADA, is perhaps most out of reach. Disabled people are still roughly twice as likely as non-disabled Americans to be unemployed and to live in poverty, and these numbers have persisted over time. While employment rates had been improving in recent years, the COVID-19 pandemic is reversing that trend. Workers with disabilities still face both overt discrimination and implicit bias. But another part of the problem, experts say, is that the Social Security benefit programs, on which many disabled people rely, come with restrictive eligibility requirements that can act as work disincentives. People with disabilities have long advocated for changes in these policies, but the rest of the country's been slow to listen. Though one in four Americans has some sort of disability, they have historically split their support between the two main political parties. Inaccessible polling places also pose a problem, says Carrie Gray, who oversees the American Association of People with Disabilities Voter Registration and Civic Engagement Campaign. That, too, is improving as younger activists like Gray, who was born the year ADA was passed, take center stage. They're bringing new, more inclusive ideas about disability rights. Naiman, who is writing a book about the history of American disability advocacy, says the increase in people publicly embracing their disability as part of their identity has played an important role in shaping new public attitudes. The COVID-19 pandemic's playing a part, with tens of millions of Americans suddenly working and attending school remotely, thousands experiencing lingering health problems. It's more commonplace to think about it, what it means to need accommodations, rely on friends and neighbors, and depend on government support. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it. And be sure to listen next time. I'm Patricia, reading for North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. So long, until next time.